Okay, well, good Friday morning, and I am really, really, really happy to be here, and I am even happier to say, not happy in a sense of I'm rejoicing in it and reveling in it, but I'm happy to say that today we are going to finish the Exodus narratives, actually, and in fact, we're not only going to finish the Exodus narratives, but really, we covered the book of Joshua pretty well, at least as well as I think is warranted, and so we're going to finish the Exodus narrative today. We're going to probably say that we may cover a few things in Joshua next week, and maybe some things in Judges, but really, we're going to start moving through, and then again, we covered 1 Samuel pretty well, so we're gonna kind of have we're going to move really quickly through, so we kind of, we spent a lot of time in Genesis, spent a lot of time here in the Exodus as we're moving back through the Old Testament, filling in these gaps. But what we're going to do is we're going to start moving a little bit faster. We're gonna start catching up a little bit more quickly. And then what's going to happen is we're going to slow way down when we get into the Kings. Okay, so we're going to move really, really fast, and then we're going to move really, really slow. And then we're going to move really, really fast again, which is really one of the nature of Bible study. And I talked about this a couple months ago at a Wednesday evening Bible study is that one of the things about studying the Bible that you'll notice is that studying the Bible is really like watching an accordion, right? The way time expands and contracts, you know, because you have the first 1,000 or so years of human history is reduced to, you know, 11 chapters of the Bible. I mean, not even, like, I mean, really, like, the first 5 chapters of the Bible, and 3 of those are talking about the first, like, generation. So you've got, like, 30, 40, 50 years that cover, like, 3 chapters, and then chapter 4 and 5, just, like, skip over 1,000 years until you get to Noah. And then from Noah, you skip over a couple hundred years, and then you get to Abraham. And then you get, in Genesis, you get the Abraham narratives, which cover, you know, 120, 130 to 150 years. Well, probably closer to 200. Probably closer to 200 years total is covered in the narratives of the patriarchs. And so you get 1,000 years covered in a handful of verses in chapters 4 and 5 of Genesis. And then you spend, you know, 40 chapters basically talking about a period of 200 years. And then you get to Exodus and you spend several books talking about a period of 40 years. And we see this pattern continues where we see, you know, the Kings gives us a pretty steady history of what goes on in the nation. But then, you know, you look at the intertestamental period, God does not have anything. There is no inspired writing from the time of Malachi to the time of Jesus. That's 400 years. And those are 400 of the most interesting years in human history. Like, the intertestamental period is like when most people think of really fascinating ancient history, that's the period they're thinking of. Right, like you've got the rise of Greece, you've got the rise of Rome, you've got Alexander the Great, you have a lot of the apocryphal works of the Bible are written in that period of time. So the Bible is not interested in giving you a uniform picture of time. The Bible is interested in showing you how God is working with certain people at certain times, and how God's activity in the world is not uniform. Like, it is not. God is not working uniformly at all times and in all places in the world. Like, that is one of the biggest errors, and forgive me, I know I'm way off topic right now, but that is one of the biggest errors that people make when they study the Bible, is they assume that because it's in the Bible and it's God doing something, that that's how God does things all the time. No. Like, God is not a uniformitarian. God does not always do things the exact same way. In fact, God rarely does things the exact same way. God rarely does things the exact same way. And what's even more impressive is God sometimes changes what he says. And incidentally, that's exactly what this text is talking about today. We're in Numbers chapter 27 today. We're in Numbers chapter 27. And what I hope we can see from Numbers chapter 27 is that God is not a uniformitarian. The commands of God are not eternal commands. Now you say, oh, Luke, that sounds like liberal talk. No, that's not liberal talk. That's learn to read the Bible talk. Okay, God's commands to the Israelites. How many of you, if you say that sounds bad, my simple question is, how many of you guys eat pork, right? Like, not all of God's commands are eternal commands. Now, some of them are. Some of God's commands are eternal commands, but a lot of them aren't, right? A lot of them aren't. And what we need to do is we need to be good at reading the Bible. We need to recognize when what something God says is eternal and when something God says is not eternal. And his law, the Mosaic law, was not an eternal law. And we can see that because it changes over time. Like God amends it. God changes it. This is a perfect example of God. If you don't understand, God is not a uniformitarian, read chapter 27 of Numbers, and you'll see that God changes in how he operates in the world. Okay? So they're talking about the inheritance, right? So they dole out the inheritances, and the daughters of Zelophehad, the son of Hepher, I'm just going to read the text for us, verses 1 through 11 of chapter 27. Then the daughters of Zelophehad, the son of Hepher, the son of Gilead, the son of Maker, the son of Manasseh, of the families of Manasseh, the son of Joseph, came forward. I'm reading rather hurriedly, so pause it if you want to read it on your own. Now these are the names of his daughters, Mahlah, Noah, Hoglah, Milcah, and Tirzah. And they stood before Moses and Eleazar the priest and the leaders of the whole assembly at the entrance to the tent of meeting and said, "Our father died in the wilderness, although he was not part of the company of those that gathered themselves together against the Lord in the company of Korah. But he died from his own sin, and he had no sons." Now, there's a sermon right there, but we're not going to go there. "Why should the name of our father be lost from among his family because he had no son? Give us a possession among the relatives of our father." So Moses brought their case before Yahweh. And Yahweh said to Moses, "The daughters of Zelophehad have a valid claim. You must indeed give them a possession of the inheritance among their father's relatives, and you must transfer the inheritance of their father to them. And you must tell the Israelites, if a man dies and has no son, then you must transfer his inheritance to his daughter. And if he has no daughter, you are to give his inheritance to his brothers. And if he has no brothers, then you are to give his inheritance to his father's brothers. And if his father has no brothers, then you are to give his inheritance to the relative nearest him from his family, and he will possess it. This will be for the Israelites a legal requirement, as the Lord has commanded Moses." Now, what do we see here? What do we see here? Well, we see that what normally happens in the law, the Levirate law, which we'll talk about, we may go into more detail in Ruth. I really hope we do, because Ruth is like my favorite passage of the Bible to preach on, at least one of my favorites, right? So there's the Levirate law, right? So if a man dies and he has no children, then his brother is going to marry his wife, and they will have children. He will raise up a son for him who will inherit his property, right? So let's say you've got two brothers. You've got Billy and Willie. Okay, Billy dies and he's married, but he has no sons. So Willie marries Billy's wife. Okay, then the first son that is born from Willie's wife will inherit all of Willie's property. Okay. Now, the second children, any children that come after that will be considered one of Billy's kids. I probably shouldn't have taken Billy and Willie, because it seemed really funny at first when I was saying it, but now I'm like, oh, this is getting confusing, right? So you've got son one and son two. Son one dies, son two marries son one's wife. The first child that son two has with son one's wife will inherit all of son one's property. If there's a second son that's born of son two and son one's wife, then that child will be reckoned as one of the sons of son two. Okay? So why is this important? This is important because Zelophehad, okay, look at what the daughters of Zelophehad say. This is their concern. Their concern is not that they're not receiving an inheritance. Okay? Daughters did not expect to receive an inheritance. That was not the expectation in that culture. The expectation was not that daughters would receive an inheritance. Okay, now you can say that that's unfair. You can say that's unjust. Okay, we can talk about that. But every society has inheritance laws. And, you know, you can inherit debt. You know, in the ancient world, you can also inherit debt. Now, you might not think that's fair, but, you know, a lot of people think that bankruptcy courts are unfair today. Like, somebody should have to pay debt. Like, why should somebody just be able to walk away from their financial obligations? You can rack up debt and then never face any consequences for it? Like, that's kind of unfair. So you can say that, you know, inheriting debt is unfair. Well, yeah, inheriting debt is unfair. And then having no recourse to reclaim debt is also unfair. You know, so anyways, we could go on about this all day long. But the point is that every society has to try to solve these problems. Every society does. And the way that the law of Moses worked was that daughters would not receive an inheritance, only sons would. Is this because daughters are less valuable? No, it's because daughters are going to go marry into another home. right? So if you give the daughters an inheritance, you're dividing up property in ways that's really weird and unnatural. Remember, this is an agricultural society. This is an agricultural society. So if, think about this, if your daughter goes and marries somebody, and probably in the same village, you're going to have plots of ground that are divided up all over the place. You're going to have all of these difficult understandings of inheritance. And what if she goes and marries somebody who lives a distance away? And then who manages the property? It gets confusing. It is easier to leave the property in individual plots, in solid plots, where things get less confusing. The daughter, when she marries somebody, she will then become a part of the inheritance that other son is gaining. This isn't a punishment. This isn't saying that women are less valuable. It's merely a way of dividing up property. And it's a significant way because your value is all in your land. So the more you divide up your land, the more you divide up your land, obviously that's going to create problems because that means that perpetually you're going to have less and less land to work because the ownership is going to become more and more diffuse. That's why the oldest son gets a double portion, because the hope is that the oldest son will probably have enough land to make a go of it and perpetuate the family line, and then his children, his brothers, may sell him the land, and they may go into, you know, either pioneering new ground, or maybe they're going to go into business for themselves, because ultimately, you're going to get problems where the land becomes so small, because it's been divided so many ways, that you know, it's going to become an issue, right? This is a real thing. This is a real problem. Okay, so if sons and daughters inherit, you're just going to have, everything's going to get too small twice as fast. Now, you might not like that daughters don't get an inheritance. That's okay. Like, you might not like that. But don't pretend that it's just mere sexism. It's not mere sexism. Like, it is that God's law has a realistic expectation of what is happening in the world. The realistic expectation of what is happening is that in the age before contraception, where children died, where, like, the child mortality rate, like, children that live to adulthood, like, I think I've seen statistics, like, as low as 1 in 10. Like, was not uncommon in the ancient world. I've seen differing numbers. But if only 1 in 10 children, 1 in 10 pregnancies, I should say, because you have to add in miscarriages, right? If only 1 in 10 pregnancies are going to make it to adulthood, like women being able to bear children is a pretty significantly important thing, right? Like, there was a significant division of labor. Like, women were devoted to raising children, baking bread, weaving, because remember, there were no factories. Like, there were no factories, textile factories. If you wanted clothes, you either had to be really wealthy and buy it, or the women of your house had to be able to spin wool or hair and then weave it on a loom. Like, that's what that comes down to, right? Brewing beer, making wine, making cheese, the dairying, the taking care of poultry. Like, women had a lot of work to do, but it was work that was built around the home because they had to be near the home, because women in the ancient world were pretty much always either pregnant or nursing. Remember, this is pre-contraception, and this is when people actually valued having kids. So women wanted to be pregnant. Like, I'm not saying that it was easy to be pregnant, but women actually wanted to be pregnant. They wanted to have large families because they saw that as a blessing of God. And frankly, if you've got pregnancy mortality rates of 1 in 10, like only 1 in 10 of your pregnancies are going to survive to adulthood, you probably want to be pregnant all the time. Because if you're pregnant and you're having a lot of kids that survive, that shows that, I mean, there's a reason to believe that God has significantly blessed you, right? That's an important thing. We live in a very different culture, right? We live in a very different culture. Today, your odds of having a pregnancy last to adulthood are pretty high. Like, in America, like, the child mortality rate is really, really low. Now, you might have tragedy, like we've experienced tragedy, our family. You know, our son, Josiah, he's got severe brain damage. Okay, does it make him not our son, but that means, like, if we lived in the ancient world and we had a son, he would have died by now. Like, we would not have the medicine for him. He would have died if we lived in the ancient world. Okay? He would never in the ancient world have survived, let alone been able to inherit property, been able to have a farm of his own, to be able to manage a farm. You know, that's just reality, right? So even with us, we have, you know, three children. One of them, if we lived in the ancient world, would have died. I mean, okay. That's how that goes. You know, even today, the number of people it's not 100%, but think about it. But it's pretty high. But think about it when 1 in 10 pregnancies survived to adulthood. Like, you, if you really wanted the family lineage, if you wanted to grow your family, it would be important. It would be very important to have children. People viewed it as a blessing of God. And so the daughters of Zelophehad, they come. And the daughters of Zelophehad understand. They're not saying that they want an inheritance, that it's unfair that only men get the inheritance. What they're saying is that it is not right that simply because, you know, that he had only daughters, that his name should die out in the clans. So what they're saying is, let us inherit the property, and then our first children will inherit our father's name. There would be the Levirate law. They're unmarried, but basically they're saying, pretend that our dad is our husband. Just pretend that our dad is our husband. And then when we marry and we have children, the firstborn of our children are going to receive our father's name. They're going to receive our father's name, and they will inherit our father's property, or at least a double portion of our father's property. However that worked, we're not entirely sure whether it would be the totality or how that would work. But that's what they say. And they say, our father's name shouldn't die out in Israel. And what does Moses say? Moses goes to the Lord, and the Lord says, yeah, they have a valid claim. His name should not die out. That's God takes significant care in the law to show that men's names would not die out. Their family names would not die out in Israel. That was a terrible curse in the land for your name to die out. When the Bible talks about somebody dying childless, it is a tragedy in the ancient world to die childless. Frankly, I think it's a tragedy in the modern world to die childless. But particularly to them, it was tragic to die childless. And to see your name die out, to see your inheritance die out, it was a bad thing. It was a bad thing. And so they're saying, look, our father allot us his share of the property, and so his name won't die out. They care about their father. They care about the legacy of their father. Like, these are good girls, good women, probably, I should say. These are good women. They care about their father. They care about their father's legacy. And God says they're right. They're right to say this. This matters to God. And that's something that we need to think about. Now I'm gonna you know, kind of get a little preachy here. Believe that, you know, like I'm gonna get a little preachy. But here's the thing: like as Christians, we need to care about our legacy. We need to care about what we leave behind us. You know, inheritance is such a crucially important idea in the Bible. Especially in the Old Testament, people care about their inheritance. They care about their legacy. They care about their family line living on. And as Christians, we should care just as much. We should care just as much. Except we don't just care about having a legacy of physical children. We care about having a legacy of spiritual children. Do you have spiritual children, friends? Do you have children in the Lord? Do you have people that you've led to Christ, and they are going to live for eternity because you have brought them to birth? Do you have that? Who have you led to Christ? Because it should be somebody. Have a legacy. Have an inheritance. If it was a tragedy in the ancient world to not have physical children to carry on your name, is it not infinitely a greater tragedy to not have led anybody to Christ? I think it is. I think it is. And you know, here's the thing. Just as a woman has to travail, a woman has to suffer, a woman has to go through the pangs of childbirth to bring a child into this world. If you want to bring a new spiritual life into this world, if you want to lead somebody to Christ, somebody has to suffer. Somebody has to travail. You know, we talked about pregnancy, we talked about birth rates and stuff like that. If you want to bring children into this world, if you want to bring spiritual children into this world, somebody has to travail. Somebody has to suffer. Somebody has to pay the high price. Now, I've watched my wife give birth 3 times. It's not a pleasant experience. I mean, it's an awesome experience. I'm emphasizing the awe part. It's an awesome experience. But she hurts. It hurts her. And it hurts me to watch her in pain. But the reality is that the blessing of having a child overwhelms the pain of childbirth. Now you say, that's easy for you to say, Luke. I'm just quoting my wife, right? Like when my son Phineas was, you know, when he was like 4 months old, and my wife had a very hard delivery for Phineas, and she's like, I'm ready to have another one. I'm like, honey, I'm not sure that you are. Like, I was there, and it was pretty, I mean, it was a hard delivery. It was a hard labor, right? But the Bible is telling the truth where it says the joy that a child is brought into the world overcomes the woman's pain. No, I'm not tough. I'm a coward. I'm a weakling, right? Like, the joy of having a child probably would not overcome my pain, right? Like, because I am a weakling and I'm a coward. My wife is not. She is not a weakling. My wife is very, very tough. My wife is a tough woman. I am not, right? I'm not a woman at all, but I'm not a tough woman either. But here's what it comes down to, right? Like, if you want to bring a child into this world, somebody's going to have to travail. Somebody has to. There ain't no other way. Somebody has to travail. If you want to bring spiritual life into this world, somebody's going to have to suffer. It's hard work to bring spiritual children into this world. It is. It is. The question is, are we willing to do it? Are we willing to face the travails, the birth pangs of bringing spiritual children into this world to make sure that we have an inheritance, that we have a legacy? It should matter to us. It really should. Like, if it mattered so much to the people in ancient Israel that their father's name would never die out, don't we care about our father's name and making sure that our father's name doesn't die out? Because we should. We really should. We should care. We should care far more about having a spiritual legacy than having a physical legacy. And I think physical legacy is important. I love children. I want to have a big family. My wife does too. And I praise God for that. And he's been good. We've been fruitful and multiplied. I want to have more kids. So does she. It's a great blessing to have physical descendants. But having spiritual descendants is even more important. Now, hopefully there's some overlap there, right? Like, that's the prayer of every parent, that there's a big overlap there. Hopefully all of your children are among your spiritual children. But we need to care about our legacy. The legacy of creating spiritual children for our God. Again, I've gone really long today, so I would say I'm sorry, but I'm not sorry. Like, I'm sorry that I'm not fulfilling my obligation to keep it at 15 minutes, but I'm not sorry about trying to teach the Bible well. So does anybody but a jerk say sorry, not sorry? Well, I'm sorry, but not sorry. So I'm sorry that I'm not keeping my goal to keep it at 15 minutes, but I am keeping it shorter, and I pray that this is still meaningful for you, even if I'm going 5 or so minutes over. But anyways, I thank you for your time. Next week, we are going to be moving on through the text. We're going to be into Joshua, Judges, Ruth, Samuel. We're going to be in that period of time, so we're going to roll on through. So thank you. God bless.